Welcome to Reinventing Professionals, a podcast hosted by industry analyst Ari Kaplan, which shares ideas, guidance, and perspectives from market leaders shaping the next generation of legal and professional services.
This is Ari Kaplan, and I'm speaking today with James Shearer, a partner at Baker Hostetler, who serves as the co-leader of the emerging technology team of Baker Hostetler's Digital Assets and Data Management Group, and Ross Guberman, the founder and CEO of Lawcatch, the developer of Briefcatch, a software platform designed to elevate legal writing, which has recently introduced new generative AI features for lawyers and legal professionals. James, Ross, great to see you.
Likewise.
Thank you.
James, tell us about your background and your practice at Baker Hostetler.
I'm a partner at Baker, but I came out of law school in 2002. I was supposed to start as a transactional attorney looking at telecommunication issues, but the firm I was going to start at collapsed. I became a product liability attorney, a litigator, and that was actually my first introduction to e-discovery at a large scale. And that was formative, certainly for my career. Went out to Dixon Shapiro, doing white-collar defense and insurance coverage, policyholder side litigation. And there too, I took on a lot of discovery, and the first true autonomous projects I had were related to bigger project development, like these quantitatively complex projects, pulling in a lot of information, looking at what's happening. Went in-house at Dow Chemical, Union Carbide, Morton Salt, and Roman Haas. It's my core clients. And there I was introduced even more heavily to multinational information at scale. I was asked by some of my outside counsel to join a small boutique firm called Redgrave, and then was really truly immersed in e-discovery and information governance. And after being co-counsel with Baker Hostetler in one client matter, came over to them. And I've been with them for 10 years. And starting with e-discovery in particular, and then branching off to information governance, and then a more developed artificial intelligence, big data analytics, and governance practice for our clients. So hopefully the skills, but certainly the experience and work among benchmarked clients expanded from that.
Ross, with James talking about big data, e-discovery, information governance, analytics, AI, you practiced law for several years before pursuing a career focused on legal writing and developing Briefcatch. How is technology changing the way lawyers advocate on behalf of their clients?
I left the actual practice of law about 20 years ago, and I'd say this is the most exciting thing I've ever seen, what's going on right now with legal tech on steroids as we speak, almost week to week. I do think we're at a bit of a crossroads. You'll see an interesting and ever-changing mix of fear, sometimes legitimate fear, sometimes exaggerated fear of the unknown, fear of being displaced, fear of security on the one hand. And then on the other hand, a lot of curiosity, optimism, and excitement about the possibilities here, including making legal services more accessible to a lot more people. I don't think we figured out where we're going to end up on that spectrum of fear and ebullience, but I'm guessing it's going to be closer to the positive side when all is said and done.
James, you mentioned that in addition to your experience in law firms, you served as in-house counsel. Have client expectations of how their lawyers communicate with them changed?
When you're in-house counsel, I think you are task-oriented, and it's probably along three lines. One is, to the extent you've got outside counsel that are creating specific documents for you, whether they're litigators or they're drafting up some kind of disclosure requirements or 10K or something, that's relatively self-contained. You'd expect that, you can edit it, but you've got a form that's oriented toward that. The second part is where you're helping your in-house counsel solve their issues internally. And that might be, there's an angle of politics to it. There's a perception of cost center sometimes. Clients do not want a 70-page memo on a topic. They don't want, oh, here's what the law says, you figure it out. They want actionable issues. Sometimes I'm concerned they're going to take what I write and forward it right along. So I have to think about the context in which I'm giving advice. Clients are working with us. They are sharing the room, and I think the work product is moving much more quickly in that way.
Do you think that desire for efficient delivery of legal advice is going to just increase and increase as more and more in-house clients realize that with legal technology, law firms should be faster and faster? Or are they also concerned about legal tech? How's legal tech going to affect those expectations?
It is changing most of the clients that can afford the bigger law firms are working with multiple sets. And if some of those firms start to accelerate the way in which they respond, the directness, giving actionable answers rather than you figure it out, here's the link to the law. You're going to look to who can adapt and get answers quickly. And in part, that's because it's more challenging now than it was when I was in-house well over a decade ago. You expect answers right away. Your internal clients, if you're in-house, now expect answers much more rapidly. To the extent that we can further use technologies to increase that pace, that'll happen.
Ross, moving from clients to judges, given your work with judges around the world, how do the kind of communication skills, good writing, crafted positions that James is referring to affect the outcomes of Bet the Company Matters?
During COVID, almost all judges shifted to reading everything they have to read, mainly briefs and motions on iPads. And that actually really matters because people are much more impatient when they read things on iPads. Plus, a lot of judges are in that group James mentioned before, more traditional, we'll say, who don't like technology devices in the first place. Just as James was saying, clients always wanted accurate information quickly. Judges now, they have little patience when they are perusing motions and briefs, especially when they're looking at them on screens. And there's a real premium, more than ever, I'd say, in having really hard-hitting, compelling introductions and preliminary statements, because frankly, they're reading those pretty carefully and then doing a lot of skimming. So lots of opportunities to seize on these trends and the sort of impatience a lot of readers have if you know what you're doing.
James, as part of your practice, you help clients draft policies on privacy, information governance, records management, security, AI now. What's the key to drafting guidelines that people will follow and which can be seamlessly enforced?
We start from the premise that we're covering the broader front for what matters to the organization. And it is, what do the laws require to the extent they are? And we're in that choppiness right now with AI. We've got a couple standards among Colorado and New York, and then we've got the AICP guidance as well as the NIST AI risk management framework. So it's great that we have some building blocks that we can start to orient programs and policy language toward. But there is still a middle ground. And I think it depends on if you need a policy or your procedure. Are you coming up with a document that's going to be a reference document where you need to find things in it, but you wouldn't expect someone to read it all the way through? Or is it meant to hit a certain point? Maybe right now, if you've got the influx of generative AI capabilities and people can see a real business use for that, and you want to say, that's fine. We understand we can't get in the middle of technological adoption, but you better not put confidential information in there or information that we're licensing and we do not have certain rights to. So we can hone in, be very specific on those higher level points, and then provide for the correct or even requisite level of detail to handle some of the other inquiries that come in. We've started adopting other methods of communication more readily. So you might have a much smaller policy statement, so you can still reference it, and then you can still meet certain regulatory or audit requirements. Then you have a frequently asked question. You have something that you can put out on the website rather than on an internal document. We're seeing a much more fluid environment for where an organization begins and ends. How much do you outsource to a third party? Do you have a blank labeled website that looks like it's your client's, but it's being run by someone else? How do you incorporate all of that into an effective policy procedure so that the people who are making decisions on behalf of the organization are still aware of it and all that information has been conveyed? So there's a practical component to all of this. And it's also trying to make sure the right stakeholders, I'm not trying to give them a lot to do. I'm trying to give them opportunities to collaborate so they feel as though their orientation and their strategies are at least being considered, if not directly incorporated.
What do you think about texting clients? Is it true? Partners are not texting their clients?
You will meet the client wherever their need is. I had one project that ended up being a multi-year e-discovery opportunity, and it seriously was the third person I reached out to when I was sitting at the Hertz office in LAX. I try to direct the conversation back to those channels, but people reach out on LinkedIn. People reach out on SMS or through WhatsApp. We've seen some industries, especially financial services now, really face some institutional challenges, regulatory enforcement about managing, let's say, broker-dealer communication. But we have to be and be positioned to be flexible, because you're right. A client need, it comes from wherever. They're looking for an answer. They're not looking for a change in method of communication. We meet the clients where they are. And I think there's a client expectation that we're going to have the right technology platform to allow us to serve them wherever they want to reach us in a way that's compliant. And that's going to protect all the confidentiality and privilege assertions we have.
Ross, given James's point about law firms trying to meet the clients where they are, as a developer of legal technology to help in the drafting process, how do you ensure that your tools are evolving with the needs of your users?
One thing that's really exciting about owning one of these legal tech companies is it's so easy to constantly update your product almost instantly in response to not just user requests, but user behavior. One really exciting thing about an editing product is we have all different constituencies. So we have lawyers who have requests, but we also have in-house clients who have requests. We have judges who say, hey, you should be telling people not to use this phrase or that phrase in briefs. On the one hand, we can always improve. We can always innovate with our core products. But on the other, with everything going on in AI right now, there's almost no end to the possibilities when it comes to really helping lawyers of all types generate superior legal documents much more quickly. A lot of potential still. I think we've really only just begun.
James, has the craftsmanship involved with creating documents, drafting arguments, managing data in high stakes litigation changed due to technology?
I hope it's only improved. I believe the expectations have gone up. The polish is expected. Ross is focused on the heart and the meat of it for people who are really looking at compelling arguments in terms of phrase. If they can see problems, then they're not going to trust those areas where they're not deep enough in the weeds to also see issues. We've started to see a gradual integration of different technologies, which are going to allow us to continually improve the work product that we deliver. Ideally, we want to focus on those areas. They're not replacing practice by any means. But we hope that there's a continual improvement in the way in which you deliver those services so that our time and our focus really is in those areas that clients expect to hear from us. And they're not worried about the other things. That experience has been smoothed out. Where there have been challenges is where some practitioners have taken that process and delegated it all to the technology.
Russ, with all that in mind, what new opportunities can law firms realize with artificial intelligence?
There's a lot you can do to consolidate a lot of partners' styles in the same practice area at the same firm. So you're able to put all those collective habits together. And I don't mean just like assembling a bunch of documents and looking at what phrases are similar, but really things that are partner-specific or firm-specific. And then another one, which again, I think is just beginning, is going beyond all those things James mentioned are really important, like ensuring consistent fonts and making sure the client's name is not just spelled correctly, the right form, LLC and the like. But actually the next stage, at least for companies like ours, is really getting into things like logic. And have you actually skipped a step in your explanation? Are you going into too much detail on a point? Things that are really just weren't possible until this recent influx of incredible ChatGPT-like products. People are going to be seeing a lot of really amazing products, even just in the next 12 months.
James, how do you see law firms taking advantage of AI-empowered tools for litigators and practitioners going forward?
I don't think it's a replacement. It's a slow adoption. It's exciting for us, I think in part because we're digging into the technologies. We're asking what I think are difficult questions. It's slow adoption. It's measured. It's intentional. And clients are starting to expect it. They're saying, tell us more about how you're using these technologies to improve the delivery of legal services to us, because we're doing it and you can help us as we start to roll this into practice. If you're going to use it as part of your practice, you have to understand how it works, or you have to get someone who really understands how it works, because it's still your certification. It's still your license that you're working under, or you're getting to the point where you can't practice without the integration of these things. As we see the integration of Copilot or some of these other technologies into it, you cannot avoid that progress.
There was a really interesting post recently on LinkedIn that lawyers were going to become the ideal prompt engineers, which of course is counterintuitive. And I own a legal tech company and employ developers, and I don't know how to code. If you want to just, for example, create a custom GPT, right now you can create your own products using normal, regular English. And in fact, you're rewarded for using normal, regular, plain, clear English, which is why, for once, lawyers are being praised instead of criticized. That maybe lawyers are actually better than a lot of technical people at handling some of these challenges.
The practice of law is steeped in ambiguity. And I don't get easy questions that frequently. We're too expensive for that. There aren't necessarily easy answers. You're analogizing, you're drawing comparisons. Understanding that the way in which these technologies work for the most part is very similar. You're coming back with an approach. You're not coming back with the right answer. Frankly, even within like machine learning systems and 2 + 2 likely is 4, in some ways, like more senior attorney adoption of some of these technologies mirrors what's already been happening, which is you assign a task out to a more junior attorney or another practitioner, and they bring you back work product and you trust but verify. And the longer you work with it, the more you trust, but you always verify. It's just a matter, of course, being responsible with those tools and those technologies. And if it saves time, there are increasing pressures from clients, especially in the face of rising billing rates, for us to demonstrate how we're changing the value. TVs get less expensive. It has not been the case for us. So how are we going to turn and continue to demonstrate the partnership in the way in which we're supporting our clients, and then by extension, their defense of our budgets and our spend?
This is Ari Kaplan speaking with James Shearer, a partner at Baker Hostetler, who serves as the co-leader of the emerging technology team of Baker Hostetler's Digital Assets and Data Management Group, and Ross Guberman, the founder and CEO of LawCatch, the developer of BriefCatch, a software platform designed to elevate legal writing, which has recently introduced new generative AI features for lawyers and legal professionals. James, Ross, that was a fantastic conversation. Thank you both so much.
Thank you as well, Ari.
Yeah, thanks both.
Thank you for listening to the Reinventing Professionals podcast. Visit reinventingprofessionals.com or arikaplanadvisors.com to learn more.